WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and stress or no stress, the big banks got their stress test results on Friday, just as reports were surfacing of, pay and bonuses returning to 2007 levels. Let's talk about those and other economic indicators, including an aide to Bernie Madoff, who might be spilling the beans on how they did it this week, and the question, what good are economists anyway? Let's talk to Peter Coy, economics editor of Business Week. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
So the federal government has been conducting these so-called stress tests to determine the health of the big banks and what kind of taxpayer help or even taxpayer takeovers they might need to get lending back on track. The public announcement is supposed to be next week, but the banks got their results on Friday. Did anything leak out over the weekend?
I'm hearing that these tests looked pretty good. People are saying they were encouraged by the results of the tests. I mean, let's face it, a lot of these banks would not be making it right now without enormous government support. I think that tends to be forgotten. People focus on, you know, the results of the particular test, forgetting that it's like, yes, if you're on artificial life support, then your heartbeat's going to look okay. Just don't take away that artificial life support.
Right. If a bank made a $3 billion profit but happened to be getting $20 billion of government money, is that a $3 billion profit or is that a $17 billion loss?
Right. That's the problem right now.
And one big question, and you said they're looking pretty good, is whether they are honest or fixed tests. Because as you know, some skeptics think Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is so opposed to nationalizing the banks, so in favor of trying to get a private solution here, that he is rigging the terms of these tests to make them easy and make sure it looks like private investment can bail them out. Do you think the tests are fixed?
I don't think you even have to go that far. The Treasury Department has been quite upfront by saying it doesn't intend to let banks fail this test. Now, you know, that doesn't mean it has to be rigged or unethical or illegal or anyway. It's just they're being very frank and saying, we want to keep these banks kind of going, and we will make sure they get whatever support they need to do that.
So what's the point of the stress test?
It's really to figure out how much support they will need and whether they will need additional government investment in debt or equity.
What do they actually test? Do they play out different scenarios, like if the credit card market starts to produce X amount of default or the commercial real estate market starts crashing to the nth degree or the mth degree, how will the banks hold up in their solvency? Is it that kind of thing?
Right. Except it's not really the nth degree. It's like maybe the first or second degree. They're not pushing too hard because they know that if they create a really worst-case scenario, pretty much all the banks would fail that test. And they come up with more of a mild test with a mild increase from here in unemployment and so on.
But that's the rigging then, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you could argue that. Just rigging sounds kind of unethical. And I don't think they're very frank about what they're doing here. It's called forbearance, which is you kind of say, look, let's not push people to the wall. Let's just see if we can ride this storm out and, you know, have the bank get healthy in the long run. There's a big debate over whether that's the right solution or not, but, you know, in all good faith, that's their strategy.
And into the teeth of this lovely environment comes yesterday's front page New York Times story about the average pay and bonuses at the biggest financial institutions heading back up toward their 2007 peaks. Did you see that?
That is the kind of stuff that really drives people crazy. I mean, how could you not get angry as a taxpayer when you see that the highly paid people in these firms are just scooping up all that money that we're pouring in?
Right. And in fact, Paul Krugman suggests today that banks getting bailout funds should be treated as public utilities for the time being. How does paying bankers back up to 2007 levels make any sense to them? Just be a reporter. Forget about your own outrage or opinion over this.
Right.
How does this make any sense to them?
Their argument would be that you need the very best minds at work here, that we've gotten ourselves, we, and the banks, I should say, have gotten themselves into a fix, and that lots of money is at stake, and you want people who can trade their way out of that. And if you put in neophytes, then they'll actually increase the losses and the cost of taxpayers. That's the argument.
And by the way, there's that's the remaining employees, right, who are getting this presumably high rate of pay, with their workforces having shrunk considerably.
Right. Yeah.
So they'd rather pay poofy salaries to fewer people than keep more people in the banking industry employed.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad idea, because the amount of business has shrunk. It wouldn't make sense to try to hold on to all those employees who have been rendered surplus by the crash.
Do you really think that it's necessary? I mean, again, from your vantage point as economics editor of Business Week, what is the market for investment bankers? And what is the market today for investment bankers compared to 2007? Not to mention the fact that it's these same geniuses who got us into the mess. They're so smart and sophisticated about what they were doing. But do they really have to pay, and what salaries are we talking about? Do they really have to pay millions of dollars a year to get people to do this rather than hundreds of thousands of dollars a year? Is that the right way to ask the question?
Yeah. I've never had one of those multi-million dollar a year jobs, but if you want to nominate me for one, I'll report back later on whether I felt it was sufficient.
Right, because I understand. Maybe they feel they're competing with banks in London and banks in Singapore, but they're all going through the crash too.
It is true that some of the boutique firms have hired away some top talent from the likes of Bank of America and Citigroup and so on, and they are suffering, believe it or not, a brain drain. So, have a case. I'm not going to take sides on that one. Mm-hmm. It does seem awfully outrageous that, the taxpayers who had no fault in this are paying these salaries indirectly.
I love that phrase, boutique banks.
Yeah, boutique.
What's the lobby of a boutique bank like? What would you call a boutique bank? Would you give it some kind of, French Riviera kind of name, or what would it be?
Well, I'm sure they would have very nice suits at the door.
I guess so. Peter Coy of Business Week is with us, and also joining us briefly now is Fortune Magazine's Nicholas Varkaver. Fortune has an exclusive right now on a Bernie Madoff associate who is reportedly prepared to cop a plea this week and spill a lot more beans about how Madoff's Ponzi scheme worked. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Madoff aide you report on is Madoff's chief deputy, Frank DePasquale, from Howard Beach, Queens. How closely did he work with Madoff, and for how long?
He was at the firm for 33 years, and he was really the chief deputy for the investment operation, which was this, secretive business on its own floor, the 17th floor in Madoff's headquarters, and is, of course, the center of this entire fraud.
Madoff's headquarters, where was that in New York exactly?
That was in Midtown on 3rd Avenue around 53rd Street in a building known to New Yorkers as the Lipstick Building.
Madoff has claimed he acted alone. Is DePasquale about to admit he was in on it?
He's definitely admitting that he was involved. He's trying to hedge a little bit and claim he didn't know certain things. He's got kind of a tough row to hoe with the federal prosecutors. The top dog has pleaded guilty, and so it's a tough situation for Frank DePasquale, because he can't throw Madoff to the dog, since Madoff has already thrown himself, so to speak.
Right. So what would a plea bargain look like? What would he be trading for what?
Well, first of all, he's looking to reduce his sentence. There's no way he's going to. It's very unlikely that he would walk out with no sentence. He has information on some of the investors. He asserts that certain investors got special deals from Bernie, which could be either getting additional returns, so you maybe get an extra 20-30% bump, but also in some cases getting just the opposite. So you imagine maybe you're one of Bernie's favorites. favorite investors. You made a lot of money on some other investments. You're looking at a big tax bill. You call up Frank DiPasquale and you say, Frank, I need to cut my tax bill. And he says, okay, presto changeo, you had a 20% loss in your Madoff investment so that the investor can go to the IRS and improve his tax situation.
Wow. So that would be evidence that investors were in on some kind of scheme to the point where they knew that Madoff could and would fix their statements in whatever direction helped them.
Exactly right. Now, this would be a small circle of very favored, longtime big investors. But yes, that's exactly right.
And reading your article, your sources say that DiPasquale might surprise us in another way by clearing Madoff family members who a lot of people suspect. So that would really be an irony, clearing his family members and implicating some of the investors who we've always assumed are his victims.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, everyone assumes the family had to know. And let me just make one distinction here. Obviously, DiPasquale is the chief deputy, and it's very telling, in my opinion, if he worked on this fraud for years and saw no evidence that the family was involved. That, of course, doesn't mean that Bernie didn't tell them things about it. They may have been aware of certain things. But yes, I think his potential testimony is extremely favorable to the family.
Peter Coy from Business Week, any reaction to this evolving Madoff development, if what Fortune's got here is accurate?
Sounds like a good story. We exclusive to Fortune, so give him credit.
And Nicholas, one bizarre and kind of pathetic note from your article, it refers to this antiquated IBM computer system that Madoff used for his records. And for someone who was once head of the NASDAQ, he was almost computer illiterate.
Yeah, it's a fascinating sort of juxtaposition. He could barely turn on his own computer, but it is true that his firm made its success on the back of incredible technology. The fact that he was relying on this old computer, that is not an accident. Basically, replacing it would have entailed, bringing in all the consultants who, look at what you're going to transfer from the old system to the new system. Basically, he didn't want anybody to look into what he had there. And so ultimately, he stayed with this, 20-year-old server, which in computer terms is, this is eons old. So yes, it was a bizarre sort of red flag of what was happening there.
It's amazing they could even get parts for a 20-year-old IBM server. Nicholas Farcover, senior editor for Fortune magazine, reporting on Madoff developments this week. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Peter Coy from Business Week. Any meaning that you have thought of the Madoff Ponzi scheme to investor or government behavior in the future?
How is it going to affect? This says a lot about the quality of regulation. The SEC completely missed this one. It's a huge embarrassment. The new ideas of regulation is that the SEC may disappear as a separate organization.
Now, you have an article in Business Week asking, what good are economists? And I don't know if you watched Fox News Sunday yesterday. But here is Obama economic advisor Larry Summers appearing to ask the same thing.
There are two kinds of economic forecasters, those who know they don't know, and those who don't know that they don't know.
So shades of Donald Rumsfeld, economists who know they don't know and those who don't know they don't know. Is that the point of your article?
It pretty much is. We interviewed Larry Summers for this article, and he's been on this theme for a while, which is pretty ironic since there he is, President Obama's chief advisor, admitting ignorance on this critical problem. But he's right. And I think that there are a lot of economists who are in the first camp. They don't know they don't know, or maybe that's the second camp. But the point of my article is that there were two mistakes. One was failing to predict the we can call it a crash. The second was, now that we're in it, failing to have a consensus about what to do next. And I've gotten a lot of reaction to this article, and it usually is people trotting out one person or another who did see trouble coming or does have a plan out. And that's not my point. Of course there are people who saw something bad in the offing. My point is that there's no consensus in the profession. And so how do people who are not economists know how to judge who's right and who's wrong? It's as if physicists couldn't agree that force equals mass times acceleration. I mean, they're debating about things that should have been settled long, long ago.
Well, that's an issue for you and me, too, isn't it? Because if we're in general media organizations that are trying to make sense of economic news and economic data, and to some degree, we don't do a lot of forecasting here, but to some degree economic forecasts, trying to make sense of them all for a lay audience. What do we do with that disagreement? We could report Economist A says this and Economist A B says that, and they disagree, and I'm not sure that serves the audience, because that just kind of leaves people confused and disempowered. But then again, we don't want to draw a conclusion for them either.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how we resolve it at Business Week. First of all, we do have economists here. My boss, Michael Mandel, is a you know, PhD-trained economist, textbook author, and so on. I'm just a journalist, but I spend a lot of time talking to economists and start to develop a feel myself. So we go out and we draw conclusions. We don't just passively report the debate. But this was a time where we said, let's look at that debate just head on and examine why things have gotten to this pretty pass.
What about those who did forecast it? I know you mentioned that people responded to that, and I'm looking at our comments page right now, and that's a lot of what's coming in. Gabrielle from Brooklyn, Dean Baker warned about the housing bubble long before it burst but was laughed at. Mike from Bellport, there were plenty of economists who saw this economic disaster coming. How could they not? So there were some. There were certainly websites out there with people who are, you know, less in the public eye, and yet those people to some degree were laughed at or dismissed, and the consensus of the so-called best and the brightest once again seemed to have gotten the risk analysis wrong. So what about the field of economics, and to your title, to your headline, what good are economists?
First of all, we do say that there is some value to economics. Macroeconomics done well can produce useful insights, and one of the best examples is in the 1970s, work by people like Robert Lucas and Edward Prescott, Tom Sargent, let us know that they call it the time inconsistency problem, which produced a Nobel Prize or two. You want to have independent central banks that are don't rely on the goodwill of the president or prime minister or Treasury Department of the country setting monetary policy, because that's the best way to control inflation. And that idea caught on, and it really helped lower worldwide inflation, brought it down in Latin America, across Asia, that had endemic high inflation. So that was a victory, but it's not enough. There are the fact that the Depression happened 70 years ago and economists still can't agree on what caused it and what ended it is a pretty sad commentary.
So here's a question from Susan in Kingston on our webpage it's from SuperF88, who asks, how do we improve the connection between economists and decision makers? It's one thing if the arrogant ignorant lose their money, but now that it's spread to all, what do we do?
Well, I think that the solution has to come from the profession itself. One thing that is happening that's positive is that I think a lot of economists who had tended to ignore the financial sector and have taken it for granted are just focusing in on the pathologies that can start there, and that there are such things as bubbles, and that there may or may not be a role for government to go in and pop those bubbles before they get too big. But clearly, you need to understand that sector better and not just treat it as a given that's just a matter of popping out an interest rate.
And by the way, Obama must be doing something right, whether or not on the level of economics, because if you saw the new Washington Post ABC News poll, he's got 50% of Americans now saying the country is on the right track. That's more than who say it's on the wrong track, despite all, and that compares to just 19% who said the country was on the right track on the last day of the Bush administration. So 600,000 new layoffs a month or not, Obama is somehow inspiring economic confidence.
Well, I would pick up on one aspect of that, which is the importance of confidence. This is another thing that was a little bit hard for economists to put into their models because it's so kind of fluid and iffy and hard to measure, but confidence does matter. There's a new book by Robert Shiller of Yale and George Akerlof of Berkeley, Animal Spirits, going back to that phrase from John Maynard Keynes, and taking it seriously. I think economists had tended to gut Keynes and
reduce him to a caricature of his original work. And these guys are unearthing the original Keynes and saying, yeah, animal spirits, confidence, that does matter, and it needs to be taken into account.
Peter Coy, economic editor of Business Week, thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Peter Coy's article, Who Needs Economists? Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, how the Brooklyn and Montclair Museums are dealing with the economy. Can a work of art be laid off